This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Today's economic news is, once again, brought to you by Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, as amended. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, today the 24th day of May. Glad, as always, to have you along, everybody. President Trump, it seems, has found his go-to preference for making trade policy. It lies in the aforementioned Section 232, the part of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, as amended, that lets the president impose tariffs on items that, and this is a quote, threaten to impair the national security. That's how we got to the steel and aluminum tariffs, and it's how last night the president floated the idea of tariffs of as much as 25% on imported cars. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore spent his day looking for the link between the automobile economy and national security.
Under U.S. law, President Trump can impose tariffs to protect national security. He has a lot of discretion in deciding what that means. Still,
it seems like a stretch to say that in this day and age, the auto industry is somehow crucial to national security.
Simon Lester is with the Cato Institute. Sure, maybe during World War II, when auto plants were repurposed to make tanks, but today?
These days, our military supplies are sort of separated from, the passenger car or sport utility vehicle sector.
Also, it's not like the U.S. auto industry is at risk of disappearing. But if saying the auto industry is crucial to national security is a hard sell generally, it is an even harder sell under international law. There is an exception under WTO rules that lets countries put up trade barriers for national security.
But it's actually quite narrow.
Rachel Brewster is professor of law at Duke.
They're really talking about weapons. They're not talking about generalized economic health or wanting to promote certain industries.
The fact that the U.S. is considering justifying tariffs on automobiles by citing national security is a source of concern for trade experts like Emily Blanchard.
We're like beyond the pale in terms of normal here.
Blanchard teaches at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business.
Once you start to bring out this national security argument for tariffs, it's a slippery slope.
Experts say it also sets the precedent that if you want to get out of obeying international trade rules, all you have to do is speak the magic words, national security. What then is there to stop everyone else, including China, from one day doing the same? In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The announcement out of the White House last night that the president has asked Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross to start a Section 232 investigation, which is, by the way, going to take weeks, if not months. It poses a somewhat metaphysical economic question. In this global economy, in which the biggest BMW factory in the world, just for instance, is in Spartanburg, South Carolina, what makes an imported car an imported car? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has a look at how and why things wound up this way.
Car makers have developed a supply chain that stretches around the world, partly because they wanted to save money. Wendy Cutler is a former U.S. trade negotiator, now vice president of the Asia Society Policy Institute.
These companies are looking to produce the car with the best parts at the most economical rate possible.
No matter where those parts come from, over the years, the global supply chain was stretched further as some car makers moved their manufacturing plants closer to the consumers they were selling to. Japanese automakers opened U.S. factories in the 80s to avoid quotas the U.S. imposed on imports of cars from Japan. Chris Wilson is deputy director of the Mexico Institute at the Wilson Center.
There's no doubt that that was one turning point in how the auto industry functioned in North America and how trade policy could be used to dictate to the auto industry.
NAFTA prompted other foreign automakers to shift manufacturing to North America. Under NAFTA rules, a vehicle can be exported to the U.S. without any tariffs, as long as around two-thirds of its parts are from North America. Frank Dubois teaches international business at American University.
you could purchase a four-door Honda Civic assembled in Canada with a U.S. engine and an Indian transmission.
Du Bois says you really can't go to a car lot anymore and say there's a foreign car because chances are its thousands of parts came from all over the world. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, carmaker shares did all right, as you might imagine. Otherwise, after a relatively transient North Korea dip, things were mostly meh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. That global automobile supply chain Nancy Marshall-Genzer was talking about comes into really sharp focus when you go to upstate South Carolina, where, as I said, BMW has its biggest manufacturing plant. We were there for a summer last bit, and a BMW employee named Jacob Suits said this to us about those cars.
We make German cars in America.
As Nancy was saying, a lot of the components that go into those German cars are made in America as well. Bill Braybrick is the U.S. sales manager with Zapp Precision Wire. It's a German steel company that's got a couple of factories in the United States, one of which is in South Carolina. Hiya, sir.
Hi, Kai.
Do me a favor, would you, and tell us a little bit about what your company does.
We're a family-owned German company, 300 years old. We take raw material, billets or ingots, and we form them. We cold work them. We turn them from big pieces of steel into smaller, close-tolerance pieces of steel. And then we sell those to people that machine parts or fabricate parts for a wide variety of industries, including automotive.
Tell me how you work your way into the automotive. Where do your pieces, your products fit on a car?
We supply a wide array of materials for injection systems, wiper blades, cosmetic pieces of steel. It's really a wide assortment.
So what'd you think last night, or perhaps this morning, when you read the news of this potential tariff that the president wants to put on imported automobiles?
It's strange. It's confusing, because if you look at South Carolina and you look at BMW and Mercedes and Volvo's presence there, you know, people have built factories near these plants just to better support them. It's the way the business works today. It's truly is a global market. You know, the suppliers are in the market and close and employing lots of people. So it's odd to think of these companies as being a threat in any way.
When you sit back and look at the American car industry, then, and I mean all of them, right? The Fords, the GMs, but also the BMWs in South Carolina. What is it in your mind that makes an imported car?
Well, the only thing that makes a German car or a Japanese car is where their headquarters is. And okay, maybe the profit dollars go back there and maybe there's shareholders there. But the car itself, the components and the assembly, the manufacturing, the subcontractors, the supply chain is often in that country. And in the U.S., that's definitely the case. These are U.S. companies. We're a family-owned company. I think there's lots of people in the supply chain that are family owned, and to hear that we're going to be punished or tariffed is a little confusing.
What happens to your business if the BMWs that they make in South Carolina all of a sudden become 25% more expensive overnight?
I guess that cost will have to be passed along, or it'll have to be managed. Someone has to pay it. Either they get it from the end user, or they're going to have to cut cost, and that can sometimes mean headcount reductions.
To a slightly bigger question here, Mr. Braybrick, we originally had you on the program a number of weeks ago, I think, talking about the exemption request that you had filed for some of the imported steel that you use to make the parts that go into windshield wipers and all of this. What is the status of your exemption request with the Department of Commerce? Do you know off the top of your head?
I do. We're waiting. Yeah. Huh. That's our status. As far as where the consideration is or where the ruling is, no. We don't have any word on that yet. It is a little bit tense because we have this June 1 deadline, the postponement of the tariff for EU companies.
Yep.
We're hoping for some positive news, but we're not really sure how the process is going.
Bill Braybrick, he's the U.S. sales manager for Zapp Precision Wire. Mr. Braybrick, thanks a lot for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai.
Hockey fans among you will know that the Washington Capitals are headed to the Stanley Cup Finals. Games 1 and 2 are going to be in Las Vegas, home of the NHL's Golden Knights, next Monday and Tuesday. When the series gets to Washington, though, a week from Saturday, some of the fans lucky enough to score tickets to that game are going to need some help getting home. The metro system in this nation's capital usually shuts down at 11:30 every night. But in these moments of metropolitan civic pride, some interesting public-private partnerships are shaping up, as Marketplace's Aaron Schrank explains.
DC Metro typically asks major sports teams to pay for late night service on big game nights, but Metro Board Chair Jack Evans says increasingly teams balk at the $100,000 per hour price tag.
They don't want to pay because it costs too much money, and they don't see the benefit from it.
Evans says there's nothing in Metro's budget for late night service either.
And that leaves me with only one option, which is the private sponsorships.
Sure, there are ads in trains, on platforms, and bus stops. It's key to the U.S. transit industry, says Adi Tomer at the Brookings Institution. But paying to keep the trains running?
There's obviously clear marketing opportunities for the private sector here.
Energy company Exelon threw down for Game 3 of the Eastern Conference Finals this month. And in a big rideshare pivot, Uber sponsored trains home from Game 6. That was just days after D.C.'s city council announced it may raise taxes on rideshare services. Colin Tews is with Uber.
We think really anything that gives people an alternative to driving their own car is a good thing for D.C.
Other sponsors, even more surprising. The Nation of Qatar covered train service for last week's Game 4, funneling the payment through a local business improvement district. The oil-rich country has been lavish with lobbying amid a diplomatic crisis with Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states. D.C. Metro's Jack Evans says the interesting sponsors Metro's netted should make it easier to find more partners. Game 3 of the Stanley Cup playoffs is in D.C. on June 2nd.
Maybe the Caps will win in 4 and we only have to cover one game.
If you have $100,000 to spare, give him a call. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Coming up,
he's producing some colors that approach a red. He's got some burnt siennas and kind of some orangey, rusty-looking things.
The color of money, and it is not green. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is off 0.3% today, 0.3%. 75.24,000 to 811. The S&P 500 declined 0.2%, 5.2727. The NASDAQ dipped ever so slightly, about a point, 74.24. I said it was a transient North Korea dip, but it was kind of a big one, 280 points down on the Dow at one point. We talked about the possible tariffs on imported cars. The president's threat sent foreign car makers reeling. Mazda, BMW, Mitsubishi, Subaru, Toyota, and Honda all backed up in overseas exchange trading. American automakers shifted out of park, though. GM revved up 1.4%. Ford gained about 1.5% or so. Shares of Deutsche Bank dropped after the troubled German lender announced job cuts, 7,000 job cuts to be precise. Deutsche shares withdrew 4.9% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note down to 2.97%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The college graduating class of 2008 celebrates its 10th reunion this year, although celebrates really might not be exactly the right word because the people graduating into the American workforce 10 years ago came face-to-face with the worst labor market in this country in a generation. Our project about the financial crisis and the recession that followed and how it changed this country and this economy is called Divided Decade. Today, Marketplace's Scott Tong checks in with that class of 2008, their economic lives this past decade, and how they are moving forward.
Congratulations.
College students who graduate into a recession fall into a deep job market hole. You can read the literature, or you can hear it from members of the class of 2008 at the University of Central Arkansas.
Gosh, I've worked so hard, but I just can't get anything. I remember that being kind of a kick in the teeth.
Coming into a job, if it's 30, 40, maybe 50% less than what some people are saying they expect, that can be an ego blow.
We all feel a little bit like we were lied to.
Studies suggest that recession graduates like Lena Harrison, Paul Kroger, and Candace Hoke Kennedy, they tend to fall behind their non-recession friends in terms of salary, and they don't catch up for 10, even 20 years. But there is evidence of two ways to catch up faster and erase this gap. So if you're taking notes, strategy one, move around early in your career. Philip Oriopoulos studies all this at the University of Toronto, and that's the advice he gave his grim-faced students in the dark days of 2008.
Stay flexible and be willing to consider other types of jobs or industries you may not have thought of previously. This catch-up process can take 3, 4, 5 years.
Which is much faster than the 10 or 20 years that most studies have found. 08 graduate Paul Kroger moved around. He majored in communications and film and jokes that he left college with a double BA in BS. Kroger says he realized in college that making movies wasn't for him. He wanted a more 9-to-5 job. So he started at a telecom company near the bottom, and he moved 5 times in 6 years.
So we were in Little Rock twice. We were in Charlotte, North Carolina once. We were in Des Moines, Iowa, and we were in Cedar Rapids, kind of second-tier cities, and wasn't a whole lot of flash. But there were really good professional development opportunities.
Ate a lot of peanut butter, he says. As he moved around, his salary zoomed up. And today, he owns a kitchen remodeling company in Little Rock.
The people that I've met who are successful never really rest. They never really sit back. They never really reflect too much on previous success because they're always looking for the next opportunity.
On the other hand, studies find that those who stay where they are and let inertia set in, well, they tend to remain in underpaying jobs. Okay, strategy two to dig out of a soft job market is to sit it out and go back to school. Again, economist Philip Oriopoulos.
Upgrading one's skills might be a good idea and a way to press pause and avoid having to enter the labor market in worse conditions.
That is the story of University of Central Arkansas 08 graduate Lena Harrison. She studied art history and could not find a paying job in her field or a master's program in her field that would take her. So she studied for a master's in something else, teaching high school.
I hated it. It was just miserable. High schoolers are kind of intimidating people.
So back to school she went for 2 more years to be an elementary teacher in Fayetteville, Arkansas, which she loves. It did come at a price. Harrison borrowed for that second master's degree. Her husband delayed his college education because of money, and they each worked 3 jobs to get by. They never had a honeymoon. A couple years ago, Harrison turned 30, and she looked up the average net worth of people her age.
I want to say it was like $10,000 or $12,000, and my net worth is negative, which, you know, was a little depressing on my 30th birthday that I'm worth a negative amount of money.
In the end, moving around and doing more school didn't just help Harrison recover. She says it made her more resilient. She's always got a career plan B and C, D, and E.
I always keep about 5 different plans for my future in mind and kind of simultaneously try to work towards all of them just in case one of them exists and the other does not.
Her classmate Paul Kroger says the job market drought taught him soft skills, that is, thinking critically to solve a problem and knowing his limits.
I think learning how to ask the right question starts with recognition that I don't know and then asking what is the right question.
Sounds simple, but he thinks new grads today may not have it. In general, they don't have the recession scars that he wears.
What's the hardest thing you've ever done? I ask that in interviews almost every time. What I hear from people, I'd say under the age of 30, oftentimes is mowing a yard, doing the dishes. Adversity is where skills are born.
To be sure, these 2008 graduates didn't ask for the recession adversity that they faced. They paid a price of unlucky timing. But in some cases, they emerged stronger. In Little Rock, Arkansas, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Think about this for a minute as you ponder the marvels of modern technology. The average computer monitor today can display about 16 million different colors, which is great. But getting even some of those colors onto actual things in real life is really hard, even for not especially fancy colors, like red. Zach Schoenbrunn wrote recently in Bloomberg Businessweek about the scientists doing the research to find the new red and the economics of that reward if they find it. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So tell me about the story of this piece. It's the hunt for the next great red pigment, and you do it by telling the story of the guy who found recently, I suppose, or a number of years ago, the first good new blue in 200 years. Mas Subramanian is his name.
That's right. Yeah, Mas Subramanian, he's a chemist at Oregon State University. And in 2009, he was looking for a compound that could be used in electronics. He was mixing elements together that were fairly bland and kind of flaccid colors were going into the other. They were white and gray and black. And he stuck them in an oven and out popped this beautiful, vibrant blue. It was incredibly durable. It was non-toxic. It was made from completely benign elements. It was also UV resistant. But, you know, what was interesting to Moss moving forward and other researchers was in what ways could this compound be used to create other colors and keep those same properties in perhaps a green or a purple, and the holy grail of pigments is finding a red, and that's what he's been searching for ever since.
And how's it going?
Well, the interesting thing about pigment research, as I understand it, is that, you know, these are chemists who have been studying this for a long time, and yet they stick elements together and they really still have no idea what's going to come out of the oven. So, you know, he would say he's getting closer, which means that he's producing some colors that approach a red. He's got some burnt siennas and kind of some orangey, rusty looking things, but he's moving toward it, he would say.
Give me a sense of the economic upside here. I mean, if he can find this red, I imagine, you know, Ferrari dealers and, you know, everybody's going to want a slice of it.
Right. So coming up with a durable, stable, non-toxic red that is also a beautiful red, that's something that's desirable to consumers, would be a huge windfall for whoever is able to come up with it. Just as an example, Ferrari Red earns about $300 million annually for pigment producers. I feel like if there was a red that was created that could surpass that and was a better alternative, I would think that would make you could approach the billion-dollar range for sure.
How big is the pigment market? Do you know?
Oh, it's in the billions. I think the estimate that I saw was around $30 billion. Most of that is with titanium dioxide, which is the chemical, the elements that are used to create most of the white pigment that we see everywhere, from the lines on our roads to the white powder on our donuts. And so titanium dioxide accounts for a huge percentage of the overall pigment market, but high performance pigments, which are the safest, most durable, and stable of the pigments today, they are increasing their market share, and they are growing continually as emerging markets want to move away from the more dangerous and toxic pigments. And if there is a pigment that is discovered in that red, as we're talking about, I think it would be quite valuable.
Is this going to be Mas Subramanian's pension plan? I mean, is he getting royalties from the blue, and will he profit from the red?
Well, he has to find the red first. I think he's hoping that that if he finds the red, then he can sail off into the sunset. But I think he's very proud of his accomplishment, and so he's eager to keep searching for what else Yinmin might lead to, whether it's red or other colors.
Zach Schoenbrunn. He's got a piece in the new Bloomberg Business Week. It's called The Quest for the Next Billion-Dollar Color. Zach, thanks a lot.
Great to be here. Thank you.
This final note on the way out today to the North Korea summit is off, as you know. As you perhaps also heard, though, the White House Communications Agency had already minted some commemorative coins to mark the occasion. So many people were trying to buy them today, copies of them, actually, that the White House gift shop's website crashed. Stephen Ferber's been in the presidential memorabilia business for 43 years. His advice for people trying to track down one of those coins?
Don't get caught up in the hoopla and overpay.
Although,
in history, there are examples of items that were produced in error and later it became valuable.
Well, sure, but
I don't think this will ever be the $3,000 Dewey defeats Truman.
$24.95 is the retail price at the third-party White House gift shop. Marked down this morning after the summit was canceled to $19.95 while supplies last. All right, we got to go. It was ugly early on Wall Street today, but finished closer to even. Dow Industrials off 0.3%, about 75 points. S&P 500 down 0.2%. That is 5 points. NASDAQ basically flat. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.